Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we're discussing the nationwide youth movement to end gun violence in our schools. Just this past Saturday, hundreds of thousands of students and their supporters marched in over 700 cities across the country, including 14 marches right here in the Bay Area. With slogans like Enough is Enough, Never Again, and Not One More, students are calling out U.S. politicians on their failure to make schools safe. They have a list of demands from comprehensive background checks to banning bump stocks and assault weapons to increasing funding for mental health. But how effective will student voices be when many aren't yet old enough to vote? Can they compete with the millions of dollars the NRA hands over to politicians? But they have a plan to reach across social, economic, and political lines and band together in support of common sense gun measures. But in order to exact real change, students face the daunting task of turning their activism into legislation. Practically speaking, will marching make a difference? And what will it take to turn passion into policy? Joining me here in the studio this evening to answer these questions are four student activists from the Bay Area. I'd like to introduce you to them now. We have Si Lai Fong, a senior at San Ramon Valley High School. Welcome, Si Lai. Say hello.
Hi.
Hi there. And we're also joined by Lily Connable at Encinal High School in Alameda and co-founder of the Bay Area Students for Gun Violence Prevention Coalition. Well, welcome, Lily.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And we also are joined by Maya Siegel at Crystal Springs Upland School. Welcome,
Hi,
Maya.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And joined here also by Lola Amador, a senior at Temescal High School in Larkspur and co-chair of the Marin County Youth Commission. Welcome, Lola.
Hi there. So happy to be here.
And last but certainly not least, joining us by phone is Brian DeLay, and he's associate professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor DeLay is an expert on the gun trade and has written numerous books, essays, and articles, and is currently writing a book entitled Shoot the State: Guns, Freedom, and Domination in the Americas. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. So I want to put this question to all of you. Because, as I understand, you were all involved in the marches that happened this past Saturday, where tens of thousands of people turned out here in San Francisco and hundreds of thousands across the country. What was your participation like for you? Let's start with you.
Yeah, so my participation mainly was I met up with a few of my friends who were involved with organizing it, and I went to the rally, and I met with some of the Women's March people beforehand who were training the peace ambassadors, who basically it's their job to just walk throughout the march in yellow vests and ensure that the protest remains peaceful. And so I got to see sort of some of the behind the scenes of how that training works. And then I got to sort of just head the march down Market Street.
And what did it feel to have so many people walking behind you?
It felt really good. I think part of why we protest is not only so that we draw attention from legislators, but also because I think it empowers us as organizers to feel confident in our movement that we have so much support and gives us sort of the power to keep and the courage to keep moving, even though it feels like we're facing so much opposition.
Did you ever turn around to see behind you?
You know, it's funny. I don't know that I did. I saw a lot of, like, behind me on social media and stuff when I saw photographs, but I was just so caught up in the moment. I think with the chants and everything, I really felt, like, the full anger of just what it's like to grow up with gun violence and then to be there trying to share that with the world.
And did it meet expectations of what you imagined a day like that would look like?
Yeah, I think I definitely had some idea of what it would look like just from I've participated in the Women's March and then the Climate March, and I've done a lot of protests like that. So definitely I expected it to be pretty big, and, you know, we had a great turnout. I was really, really thrilled.
Great. So, Lily, tell us about your experience.
Yeah, so I was at the March for Our Lives of Oakland, and I spoke there, and then I was leading the march to Lake Merritt, which is where all of the participants from Oakland marched to, and then some of them went off to San Francisco, but I finished up there. And for me, it was really powerful because Oakland is a city that's really, really affected by gun violence and of issues like police brutality and things like that. So to be there among people who've personally experienced that type of violence or know people that have personally experienced that type of violence was really humbling and something that I feel like was a unique standpoint that maybe not necessarily all the marches were able to have because of their geographical location. And I loved that the organizers of the March for Our Lives of Oakland really capitalized upon that and had a very diverse group of speakers to speak on their experiences with gun violence.
And Celi, you spoke to the crowd here in San Francisco, is that correct?
Yes, I did.
What was that like for you?
It was a really amazing experience to look out on the crowd and just be able to share my message about gun control. I think that it was it was just kind of shocking to see all the support and to see all the anger and all the people that were just ready to get things done.
Hmm. And what message did you want to make sure the people who either attended or were watching from home got from what you had to say?
That gun violence is really affecting all students now. It's not just, I mean, obviously there's the kids that have grown up in certain areas that experience gun violence every day, but you also see the effects even in more affluent areas where kids are, where kids at schools, we have active shooter drills now and things like that. So it's really becoming a culture. It's a cultural aspect now.
And Maya, you also spoke on Saturday, is that right?
Yes.
And tell me, what was your message when you got in front of the microphone?
So I was the first speaker, so mainly it was introducing the event and, you know, laying out what was to come. But I hope that what people got from my speech was that this is, like Celia was saying, this is a culture that is just so normalized and is so... we've grown up in this culture that is not normal. It shouldn't be happening. And I hope adults especially, from the entire rally, took away the idea that this is something that they didn't grow up with and it's something that no one should grow up with.
Actually, that was a very interesting segue. What was it like to see the people of your age group leading this and having the adults perhaps following? Yeah, Lily.
So to me, I think it's very natural. I think that young people are incredibly passionate about social issues. There's this common misconception that we're just caught up in our phones and we're not aware, but actually in those phones, we're organizing and we're learning so much about what's happening in the world around us. And I think we're getting a very diverse standpoint on that. So as I said, I think it was natural. I think young people were born to make change. We saw that at the Civil Rights Movement. We've seen it throughout history. And this is another time that we're seeing that happen.
Yeah, go ahead, Maya.
And I definitely want to add to that. Like Lily was saying, I think a lot of people see our generation as just a bunch of kids who are always kind of caught up in social media or on their phones. But because we have access to things like social media, such as, you know, Instagram, Facebook, the news, the internet, we tend to, I think we're very aware of what's going on around us to a point that adults don't really understand. And I think we're aware enough and we are passionate enough to make change when we feel it's necessary, and this is definitely an area that needs to change.
How did your respective parents, some of whom are watching in the wings here, react when you told them that you were going to participate in the ways that you did?
Well, my parents were certainly not surprised. I've been doing stuff of this nature for quite a while, and I think they knew how upset I was about the issue. One of the things I'd like to add just about the social media thing is that because of that connectedness, I think that these events, these mass shootings, but also the daily violence in a lot of communities of color, low-income communities, feels a lot more real to us because we're all connected to the news. I know how I found out about Parkland was I woke up and, you know, I get Washington Post notifications on my phone and I opened it up and I saw it. And then It was just active shooter, and there wasn't really much more information. And I went to Twitter, and I ended up seeing a lot of the like live tweets of some of the students at Parkland. And to me, I think, and I hope I speak for a lot of other young people, that really made it feel so real, because it was like you were experiencing it with them at the same time.
Others' experiences negotiating this with your parents?
My parents have been really supportive the entire time. Again, I've done Model UN. I used to do Model UN. I'm generally pretty involved in politics. I'm definitely passionate about politics. So this was definitely something that I wanted to do, and my parents have been very supportive in making sure that, you know, anything that I need to do, especially I can't drive, so a lot of this has been, you know, getting places, driving to meet with other students, or, you know, to meet with press or other organizers, and they've been really supportive in not only driving, but, you know, helping with anything I need, whether it be conceptual or otherwise.
Yeah, Silai.
I think my parents have also been extremely supportive throughout just this entire process, from, like, the walkouts on the 14th and organizing and all that kind of stuff up until March for Our Lives on the 24th. And I think that they realize that the reason that I'm so active is that I, along with all the other people in my generation, we see a world that we don't care for it. We don't care for the injustice that we see around us, and we're just trying to rectify those mistakes so that our children don't have to live in that kind of world where we just feel unsafe, even in a place like school.
Are any of the four of you from families that have activist histories? I see not so much. Okay, kind of interesting, right, if you think about it, sort of where did this all come from, right? So I wanted to circle back around to something that you said. You've given a lot of credit to social media and those of you who use it, which are all of you. If there weren't social media, do you really think that we would be having this conversation? Or is social media really the main factor here, or is there something else? Silai.
I think that throughout history with youth movements, there hasn't been social media. You see that with the civil rights movement and Vietnam, and those were a lot of young people that just came together and said that we don't like what we're seeing. And I think that social media definitely helps. It allows us to keep in contact with people all around the country, with people all around the Bay Area, and to organize and to make things more efficient. And so I think that's why you see such a huge turnout in for the March for Our Lives, like in places like Washington, D.C., it just allows everything to run smoother.
Maya. Yeah, and I've grown up with social media, so I can't really speak to the dynamics of events that occurred before I was born. But besides, you know, social media helping these movements, I think it's just different from what I understand. You've seen with the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, a lot of those started out as hashtags on Twitter, and they're able to grow in just a way that's so different from, you know, the media was before. Everything grows so fast, and you're able to spread information with just a hashtag, which is really crazy if you think about it, and you're able to rally people. And, you know, words like Me Too, and especially the hashtags, can be so powerful, you know, in a way that you really wouldn't imagine they would be.
Lily.
I actually think it's really interesting because I read an article last week by Malcolm Gladwell about, you know, how impactful social media could actually be in organizing today and the authenticity of it. And I think it's an interesting paradox because we have it making it makes it very available for students to get involved, and I think that's amazing. But it makes it easy. But it also, I wonder how well it fosters sustainable change, and I think that's going to be something for us to really watch for in these coming months, and how we can continue to use it as an amplifier and as a tool for things that are concrete that we want to see happening.
Yeah, Lola.
Yeah, I just want to add to that. As much as it definitely facilitates organizing, I think it also makes it hard to hold the national attention for as long as it takes to create change in some ways, because we're so connected to our phones and the media. I know so many people in my lives just have the instant news notifications. And so when you have so much going on and you're so bombarded with news, it's hard to hold the focus sometimes.
It's just a matter of minutes till the next hashtag, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So be interesting. We'll get to this question later in the hour of where do you take it from here? Because marching is one thing, organizing is one thing, but actually creating change is yet another. I wanted to bring in Professor DeLay, Brian DeLay from UC Berkeley. Just some thoughts as the other adult in this conversation, although I actually feel like we're outnumbered here. what's your take on what you're hearing?
Well, you know, it gives me a lot of hope. There, you know, those of us who were adults during some of the other horrible, heartbreaking massacres, most especially Sandy Hook, you know, can all remember, I think, the feeling of disbelief and despair when we realized that nothing was going to change after an event like that. And to see the students in Parkland and then their peers around the country take leadership in the way that they have in the last 5-6 weeks has been inspiring. And, you know, I can be a little bit of a cynic, but I actually think that something meaningful is changing in the way that we are going to be moving around this issue of guns in this country.
And actually, you mentioned Sandy Hook. Why was this particular tragedy the one that seemed to light the spark, so to speak, here, as opposed to Sandy Hook, in your mind?
Well, you know, there's a brutally, sort of heartbreakingly mundane reason, and that is that the kids in Sandy Hook were all like 6 and 7 years old. So they weren't going to jump on CNN, and they weren't going to be on Twitter, and they weren't going to be leading a nationwide movement. That was part of the reason. It's also true that Sandy Hook did help inspire the beginnings of an infrastructure to try to match the NRA in terms of organizing and promotion and logistics and getting a counter message out there. And that machinery took years to mature. And we are now at a point where it is far more sophisticated and far more formidable than it was even a few years ago. And I think that both these things are at work in explaining why the Parkland shooting had such very different, you know, short-term consequences.
Any of you want to add to that? Lily?
One thing that I think is really interesting about this in particular, and perhaps one of the reasons why it has been such a big movement, is because I can speak for myself and probably others in here. I remember when Sandy Hook happened. I was in sixth grade, and before that, I had never done a lockdown drill. But after that, I had them, you know, continuously throughout my schooling. And I think that it's this very marked difference because people kind of wrote off Columbine as this kind of one-time thing, in a sense, even though we had a lot of college shootings. But we remember when we didn't have to do that. And now we're knowing that we have to do it now. And I think that's one of the reasons why we feel that it's so unacceptable and why we're making so much noise.
Yeah, Lola and then Maya.
I also think that one of the main differences is that with Sandy Hook, you know, they were so young, the victims, that they didn't, that the argument that let's not politicize this moment, we should be thinking of the victims, still was really effective. But now with Parkland, when some people say, oh, let's not politicize this, think of the victims, what have you, the students from Parkland are able to say, we are the victims and we want change. That's how you honor our peers who have died.
And Maya?
Yeah, I just wanted to circle back to something you had said about, you know, after Sandy Hook, from an adult's perspective, experiencing the disbelief. And I think that's one of the worst parts of this gun culture in America, at least for students today, is that these, you know, these shootings happen so often that to an extent we're kind of numb to the disbelief. And that's a really scary thought. And it really, you know, every mass shooting is a terrible incident, and it's just it's horrible that, you know, when people see mass shootings that are maybe, you know, less than a certain number, they're like, this isn't that bad, which is so not true, and it's just a thought process that, you know, shouldn't be happening.
Just in case you're just tuning in, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking with Bay Area students about student activism that's now driving the debate on gun control. Are you a current or a former activist who would like to share your experience? Are you a burgeoning youth activist in this the recent wake of the recent events in Florida. We'd like to hear from you. Call in with your questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or follow us at on Twitter at CityVisionsKALW. So I wanted to turn our conversation now to what actually you are asking for. Okay, you mentioned a little bit in your initial comments, but you know, we talked a little strategy. Now let's talk to substance. What are you hoping to achieve? Who wants to start? Lola, go ahead.
I think one of the things that we're really pushing for, some of the main things, are banning assault weapons, which, you know, there's a lot of contention about what the exact definition of that is, but I think semi-automatic and automatic weapons, bump stocks, which turn semi-automatic weapons into fully automatic weapons, silencers, which I think would have played a really large role in the Las Vegas shooting had they been used. One of the main ways that they were actually able to find the shooter and stop him was by listening to where the gunshots were coming from. And then also gun violence restraining orders, which basically allow families or local law enforcement, and in some cases, depending on how they're set up, coworkers, people who are close to a person, to temporarily take away their firearms if they're thought to be in an unstable position. They could be a danger to themselves or others. But I also think that it's really important to focus the measures that we're pushing for, not just on what would prevent these mass shootings, but also on all types of gun violence, including police brutality, which is another form of gun violence that is particularly prevalent. And for that, I think that we definitely need more explicit standards for appropriate use of force for law enforcement, because right now it's largely dependent on what the, quote, reasonable officer's judgment is. I think we need to federally mandate the use of body cameras and also ensure that the footage is publicly accessible. And I think that we need a better method for, or I think we need to demilitarize police officers as well. Just since the start of Program 1033, California state and local police officers have accepted over $160 million worth of former military equipment. And I think that there's absolutely no reason that we should have our state and local law enforcement riding down the streets in tanks.
Mm. So that's actually something that I've heard a little bit about, this kind of joining this movement with a call for an end to police brutality and an increase in police accountability. But when you're listening to mainstream media, not so much. Do you feel like this is a topic that's coming out of Bay Area discussions, or are you seeing it elsewhere? Celi?
Well, actually, some of the Parkland students have mentioned police brutality as part of the gun violence issue. So while it's obviously it hits very close to home for people in the Bay Area to be talking about police brutality, it's definitely something that people our age are bringing into the conversation. I mean, obviously, with the Parkland students, they've checked their privilege and they've said, well, we know that part of the reason that Parkland got so highly covered is because we are predominantly white school. And so they are the ones that are bringing this into the conversation at a national level and saying that we need to also be focusing on other aspects of gun violence, not just school shootings. We can't just mourn when it's certain students being killed. We need to mourn when all students are being killed.
I wanted to bring in you, Brian DeLay, there. In terms of strategy here, what's it like to try to broaden the approach here to include police brutality? Is that liable to sort of splinter this movement or to make it less effective if you're kind of you're spreading your attention more thinly, or perhaps where you might have allies in one situation, when you add another plank, so to speak, to your platform, that you might alienate some potential allies?
I think that's a distinct possibility, that some people that would be able to get behind some proposals would balk when you expand it into others. But, you know, for me, the engine of this movement is a kind of moral clarity. And the fact is that, you know, police brutality, especially for communities of color, is a massive problem in this country, as is everyday gun violence. You know, I mean, I think Lily mentioned that school massacres are, as horrific as they are, they make up a tiny, tiny percentage of total gun victims in this country. Black kids are 10 times more likely to be killed by a gun than white kids. And that's the kind of fact, bare fact, that the movement for gun safety has to put front and center if it's going to maintain that moral clarity and if it's going to maintain the passion and the energy necessary to see it through to genuine change.
And I want to stay with you for a moment. When we see the numbers of people and kids, young adults and adults coming out in support for tighter gun control, and you see rising numbers of Americans across the political spectrum who are also in support of it, is there just a clear, solitary other side to this, which is represented by the NRA, or is it much more diffuse?
Well, you know, opinion polls on these issues change, and for most of the last 20 years or so, Americans have become more conservative on this issue, generally. Majorities still, even before Parkland, support a number of different kinds of reforms, some of which have been embraced by the Parkland students. So universal background checks have been, you know, popular for a very long time, banning high-capacity magazines, banning assault-style weapons. But the number, the sort of like the edge that the majority has had been shrinking before Parkland. And that's now changing. And so we see this renewed interest in and acceptance of significant gun reform measures. And so that's an opportunity, but we're at a political moment when that opportunity could only conceivably be realized with the election of Democrats. You know, it's the Parkland students are wise and correct at a certain level to say that this is not a partisan issue. But the fact is that the NRA has so tightly aligned itself with the Republican Party and gives the vast majority of its resources and its attention and its get-out-the-vote energy to the Republican Party that it's really no mystery why Republicans refuse to embrace these kinds of forms we've been talking about. So from my perspective, the real end game for this movement, at least in its first stages, has got to be to elect a Democratic Congress and then in 2020 a Democratic president, and then real reform is possible.
Maya, you wanted to add something there.
Yeah, I just really quickly wanted to add on to something you were saying about gun control that a lot of Americans support and federal acts in the past. Just wanted to bring up the Federal Assault Weapons Act. This was an act that passed in 1994 that actually banned assault rifles, as well as I think there were certain magazines that were banned as well. And this expired in 2004 and wasn't renewed. But I think, and there are many loopholes, so it wasn't entirely effective, but I think it would definitely be in our interest to revisit that, maybe kind of close the loopholes and revise it a little bit. But it does show that, you know, our country, we've had these gun regulations in the past, and I think it would definitely be worth our time to go back and look to those for any gun legislation we try to pass in the future.
Lily.
Yeah, and I'd just like to add on one thing that I think is really crucial that we're talking about is the Dickey Amendment, which says that the CDC cannot conduct studies and research on issues of gun violence, some certain issues of gun violence in this country, which seems, you know, to me completely illogical and, like, really concerning, because the CDC is our one of our biggest processors and presenters of public health information, and it's essential that they can do research on gun violence. One other thing that I wanted to tack on to what Brian was saying about the issue of gun violence affecting disproportionately people of color and police brutality is that there are certain precedents that have been set by various Supreme Court cases that say that you cannot go into a court and blame racial bias or profiling as the reason that you were shot. And to me, that's really an issue and something we need to talk about. We can't have this conversation about gun control and gun violence unless we're including the people that are most impacted. And I think that that is something that is a strong message that we have to carry forward, even if it means that we do lose some supporters.
Mm. Loa.
Yeah, I just wanted to also add that I agree that until we elect Democrats and we're going to have a hard time setting a federal standard for a lot of these measures. I think there's a lot of reform that can happen at the state level, but one thing that really threatens that I'm worried about is a bill called Concealed Carry Reciprocity, which basically would mean that concealed carry permits would have to be recognized by all 50 states. In some states, you can be a convicted stalker, a convicted domestic abuser, and still legally obtain a concealed carry permit. So that really concerns me. As a student in California, I feel like activists have done a really good job pushing our legislators, and to their credit, our legislators have done a good job of listening to their constituents and passing comprehensive gun control reform. But the concealed carry reciprocity is a huge threat to that.
Again, I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking with four Bay Area high school students about gun control and the upswell of protests over the last several weeks since the shooting in Parkland, Florida. We're joined by Celai Fong at San Ramon Valley High School, Lily Connable at Ensenal High School in Alameda, and co-founder of the Bay Area Students for Gun Violence Prevention Coalition, Maya Siegel at Crystal Springs Upland School and speaker at the March for Our Lives in San Francisco on Sunday. Also, Celai spoke there, and I believe, Lily, you spoke in Oakland. And Lola Amador, senior at Tamaskal High School in Larkspur and co-chair of the Marin County Youth Commission. And earlier this month, you represented your school at Congressman Jared Huffman's Student Summit on Gun Violence and met with state legislators about this issue in Sacramento. And by phone, we're joined by Brian DeLay, associate professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley, who's an expert on the gun trade. Again, we have full phone lines now, but I'll put that phone number out there for you to join our conversation. It's 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. If you can't get us by phone, you can email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionsKALW. So let's go to Ben from Burlingame. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Ben from Burlingame, and I have a question for you guys on the radio show. My question to you is, what solutions do you propose to end the issue of gun violence in our country?
All right, Ben. I'm going to have you hold for a moment, just in case you want to do a little bit back and forth with our guests here. Anyone want to take Ben's question? Go ahead, Celai.
Well, like Lola mentioned earlier in the program, I think that it's important that we have universal background checks. We ban bump stocks and assault-style weapons as well. And then in addition, a lot of people are calling for a raised age on your ability to buy a gun.
Lola?
Yeah, I'd like to add to that real quick, just because I've heard, as we have these conversations, some confusion between comprehensive background checks and universal background checks, and I actually think we need both. Comprehensive background checks, of course, means expanding what they look into when they complete the background checks, but universal background checks is really crucial because it's about expanding background checks to all gun sales, including gun shows and private sales.
All right. Anything to add there, Ben? Do you have an idea you wanted to share?
No, but one, thank you so much for having me. And two, I really like the idea of universal background checks. Can you explain how those work? I haven't done my homework.
How about Professor DeLay? Could you help us with that?
Well, the background checks are one of the most important things that we can do to improve gun safety right now in the country. Right now, federally licensed firearms dealers are required to run background checks when they sell firearms, but private sales and many kinds of online sales are not required to do this. And so consequently, a very significant percentage of guns that change hands in this country do so without a background check, including the large majority of guns that are used in crimes. So significantly improving and mandating universal background checks would be one way that you know, large majorities of Americans support to help improve gun safety in this country.
Thanks very much, Ben, for your call. Let's go next to Pam from San Francisco. Pam, welcome to the program.
I had a couple of things. One was, I heard something kind of clever that you might want to consider for anyone who wants to buy a gun. They have to go through a similar procedure that women who want to have an abortion have to go through. Watch wait for 48 hours. Watch a film that shows what disasters they can cause by what they're about to do. You know, some scare tactics might go a long way in that regard. And some of the other things that are women are required to have to go through when they're, you know, going to cease their pregnancy, and when prospective gun buyers are likely going to cause carnage of some sort or another, or possibly going, not likely, but possibly. And then the other thing I wanted to say, I really want to emphasize how much I'm heartened by the incredible consciousness that a lot of the students seem to have around the importance of unifying with other organizations. And yes, there's some reluctance to do that because they might lose some of their momentum, or they might have to work a little harder to find common grounds on some issues. But I think it's much more ultimately going to be a stronger movement if that those connections can be made. And because the system is a lot more afraid of people who've united. My friend Flo Kennedy would always use this analogy. Would you, if you were the establishment or the NRA, for example, would you rather see one lion coming after you or a million mice? And I think the million mice can do a whole lot more damage and be put out, silenced a lot more, with a lot more difficulty than one lion. So if you know what I mean, like if it's one organization that's all neat and cohesive, and if they want to discredit you, all of a sudden you can be easily done. But if there's a lot of different people together unifying around the same issues with the same goals, it's more threatening to the NRA. And that's, I think, important. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Pam. Anyone want to respond to Pam's comments? Maya.
Yeah, so I just wanted to respond to what you were saying about, you know, people that want to get guns having to go through the same process as women who want to get abortions. And I've definitely seen people suggesting things like that, similar to that, such as, you know, going through the same process that people have to go to get cars. I know many countries, especially Japan, have really rigorous processes to get guns, such as tests, all these waiting periods. But I also wanted to emphasize, kind of on this point, that California does have much stricter gun legislation than many states in this country. So we definitely want to focus on federal legislation. But that being said, there are still certain, you know, empty spots in California, including permitting and licensing. So I think it's a common misconception, you know, with kids from California and adults as well, that just because, you know, we're from California, which is a progressive state, there's not much that can be done, which is entirely untrue. There are definitely spots to be improved upon.
All right, let's go to our next caller. We have Alex from Novato. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. I just wanted to kind of comment on something Brian DeLay was saying a little bit earlier about sort of finding sort of partisan common ground, if you will. You know, kind of like when I was organizing the my event over at up at Marin Catholic and up in Kentfield, you know, kind of like I had a lot of conversations with more conservative students, and kind of like as we were sitting down to sort of have these conversations, I kind of found myself agreeing on a lot of issues, things like background checks and banning bump stocks, those types of solutions. And we ended up sort of finding common ground, and we ended up having this really sort of great event where we sort of brought the entire school community get together, very, very sort of action-oriented. But my question is, and this is sort of a conflict that that I've been thinking about, I think a lot of people have been thinking about, is sort of, are those sort of common-sense solutions enough, right? I know Mike Thompson has a bill sort of going through the House where he proposes sort of some of these common-sense solutions, background checks, et cetera. But a lot of people are saying that you need a lot more sort of decisive action, that we need to sort of reduce the number of firearms in the United States in order to really have meaningful change. So I'm wondering, and maybe I can pose this question to the wonderful panel, do you think those common sense solutions are enough, or do we need to take more aggressive action, or do we kind of need to take what we can get?
Lily, sorry, I couldn't tell if you were saying yes or no there. Sorry, Celi.
Sure. Okay. So,
one, two. Go ahead.
Sure. So, I think that it's really important to note that, as Maya was touching upon earlier, California does have a lot of these common sense gun control laws that are the smaller changes, but we have reduced our gun deaths significantly. We're actually 43rd in the nation overall for gun death, according to Giffords. And so, we see that these sorts of things do work. And I also think that it's a better way to, as you said, find common ground. I'm from Georgia. I know a lot of people that feel very strongly about their right to bear arms, and I think that being very decisive and divisive here could be a potential way to alienate people that could be on our side in this movement. And it's really important that we do hear all people's voices in this, and so I do think that it's certainly the place to start. Celi?
I would definitely agree with that. I think I hear a lot of people saying that we should just get rid of all guns, you know, follow the model of Britain or Australia, start doing buyback programs. But I think that's really not the way to go. I think that what we should start with is definitely things like universal background checks, banning bump stocks, all those solutions that we've been talking about. And then from there, we can kind of evaluate how well things are going and what more needs to be done, and just take action as it comes up. This obviously is an issue that's going to take a very long time to be resolved, and we just really have to keep at it over time and sort of adapt as certain issues come up.
So, Brian DeLay, I want to bring this question to you then. If we're talking about trying to widen the support for gun control and try to reach across the aisle or across the country, as it were, what do we need to understand about America's relationship to guns and beyond the NRA to be able to really push through the typical rhetoric that just keeps bouncing back and forth?
Well, you know, the NRA represents or has something like 5% of American gun owners as members. So it's important to remember that American gun owners aren't necessarily aligned with the NRA or everything that the NRA is pushing for. And I absolutely believe that the way forward is to engage in respectful conversation with people that disagree with us. You know, that kind of thing is in short supply a lot of times these days. But it's, you know, there are all kinds of people who are gun owners who don't see themselves as villains, don't see themselves as callous, don't see themselves as indifferent to children's lives or to the lives of people living in cities, and you know, they can be engaged. I grew up in a house full of guns. My dad is a NRA member and a gun collector and a hunter, and you know, and it doesn't. We're not going to get very far demonizing everybody. That said, hard decisions are going to have to be made. There's a reason that, you know, many Republicans, for example, are willing to talk about banning bump stocks. And that it is, you know, in the grand scheme of things, a very trivial move. You know, yes, they were involved in this horrendous massacre in Las Vegas, but in the big picture of gun violence in America, it wouldn't even register. So the bigger ideas, a renewed assault weapons ban, one that's more skillfully crafted than the last one, a limit on high-capacity magazines, genuine mandatory universal background checks, these are the kind of things that could actually put a dent in gun violence in the United States. And, you know, many people are going to disagree with that. And so it's about political victory.
All right. I want to bring in David from Berkeley. David, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. One suggestion about possible semantic framing with respect to talking about these issues. And let me preface this by saying, of all the rhetoric and conversation I've heard about this issue, this is probably the most intelligent conversation that I've heard on the media so far. So congratulations to all of you for that. I'm wondering if the panelists think that the following phrases might resonate. One has to do with lifting restrictions on research into gun-related violence, and I would suggest thinking about the phrase, unleash the CDC. The second phrase that I would like to suggest has to do with background checks, and I would like to see people talking about airtight background checks. Airtight background checks. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, David, for your call. Let's go next to, let's see here, Isabel from Mill Valley. Isabel, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just have a question. So I'm currently a junior in high school, and for the last month or so, I've been trying to do as much as I can to get my community involved in the conversation and action surrounding gun reform. And so now that the march is behind...
Isabel, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second. Do you happen to have your radio turned up? We're just getting a lot of feedback suddenly.
Oh, sorry. Let me see if I can turn it off.
Yeah. Sorry, it's unfortunate, but... You can listen later on the podcast. Go ahead.
Is that better now? Okay,
not much better. Thank you.
So I'm currently a junior in high school, and for the last month or so, I've been trying to do as much as I can to get my community involved in the conversation and action surrounding gun reform. And so now that the march is behind us, what can I do as a student to keep up the momentum in my community as we approach elections in November, especially as I'm a student who won't be eligible to vote in those elections?
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Isabel. This gets us really nicely into the next question, which is voting, right? Professor DeLay keeps saying that that's really going to be the game changer here. Who wants to comment on that here?
Sure.
Go ahead, Lily.
So I want to, include my peers in this as well, but I think that one thing that you can do as a student is volunteer on campaigns in districts that can be flipped to be blue, especially in California. We have 14 districts that we're trying to flip right now, and a lot of those include incumbents who are taking a significant amount of money from the NRA. Jeff Denham, for one, is one of the biggest offenders in this case. And if you go to work on that campaign, you can do that at home. You don't even have to go anywhere. You can get on the phone, call voters, or you can go in Canvas and actually work in an office for whoever is opposing those candidates. That's one of the most effective things you can do, because, as Ryan said, this is the way we're going to change these things.
Yes, Maya.
Oh, and I know that you had mentioned that you won't be old enough to vote in the midterms, but I think it's definitely important to pre-register to vote so you're, set and ready. It's a pretty simple process. You can do it when you're 16, so I would definitely recommend that to anyone, that wants to get involved, and everyone in general. I think there's this idea that, I've seen a lot of articles that kind of, I want to say, bash our generation for not turning out to vote, but I want to make sure that everyone knows that every vote does matter, and I think a lot of people think that their individual vote doesn't make a difference, but really their voice does matter and their vote does matter. So even just by voting, especially in the midterms where turnouts aren't as large as just the presidential elections, they're super, super important, especially in electing out officials that take money from the NRA.
Maybe getting adults around you to vote and walking them to the polls or to the mailbox with their absentee ballot. One solution that I haven't heard any of you talk about is arming teachers. We got to hear from you about this. All the hands went up. Lola, Celi, Maya, and Lily. Go ahead.
Quite possibly the worst idea I've heard to end this problem. So one of the things that I think gets left out of this is guns into schools. And then I also just would like to mention, in general, this goes for any person who uses guns for self-defense. You're far more likely to have that gun taken from you and used against you than you are to use it to defend yourself.
Celi?
I personally oppose any fear-based solution to gun control. I think that this is definitely a situation where everyone's afraid. But solutions like arming teachers and having things like bulletproof doors, it's not really adding anything to the conversation. That's a solution that's obviously... There's so many issues that could arise. I know that a teacher somewhere in California was doing a demonstration on how to load your gun, and a student was actually injured during the demonstration. And also, when we're talking about school shootings, there are a number of school shootings that take place because teachers are the ones bringing guns to school and shooting their bosses or their coworkers. So I think that arming teachers is just... There's so many things that could go wrong as opposed to maybe the few things that could possibly help.
Maya, a brief comment, because I want to get to us a couple more issues before we wrap. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I just wanted to mention two things. First of all, I've talked to a lot of my teachers about this, and they said from a teacher's perspective that many teachers actually don't support this idea, and a lot of them wouldn't feel comfortable having guns. And then I think to the larger issue, having teachers with guns or bulletproof doors, that's just avoiding the point that, it's missing the point entirely, which is that you know, schools should not have to have armed guards. Schools should not have to be defended with guns. You know, active shooters shouldn't be there in the first place. And really the only way to do that is by passing gun control.
All right. I wanted to turn in the last couple of minutes just a little bit off track here for 1 second, which is, you know, one thing to think about is to decrease access to guns. Some of what is described as one of the reasons why these events happen is disaffected students, or students who either have been bullied or alienated or isolated socially. What's your take on how much of that is a real issue here, or and if so, what should be done about it?
I think that the idea of it's just the alienated students and just the bullied students that you need to be looking out for is very misconstrued. Because if every bullied student was a school shooter, then you would see a larger number of school shootings. I mean, school shootings are obviously very tragic, but they make up for a minority of the gun violence issue in America. The mental health aspect is definitely something that needs to be discussed, but when we hear politicians saying that mental health is the only aspect that needs to be discussed, that's where it starts getting sidetracked. Obviously, that there is a responsibility to be helping students with mental health issues, but not every student with mental health issues is a potential school shooter.
Lola.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. I think that mental health is super important, and of course I'm a huge advocate for that as someone who's struggled with it myself in the past. But I think that a lot of times when politicians bring up the issue of mental health in regards to gun violence prevention, it's often a distraction from doing any real action that would help the problem. I also think with regards to bullying, the vast majority of shooters are white males, and, you know, to some extent, I'm sure bullying and social isolation is a part of the problem, but I think that a lot of it has to do with hate. I think far too much attention has been paid to the fact that the Parkland shooter was, you know, mentally ill, socially isolated, bullied, what have you, and not enough has been paid to the fact that he was affiliated with the white supremacist group, that he openly and explicitly expressed his hatred of his Black and Jewish peers, that he had a swastika carved in his gun. And so I think that if you want to talk about changing the school environment, the focus needs to be more on, you know, preventing the racism and the sexism that we see in schools, because that is a huge problem. And I think that it's an entitlement issue more than it is a social isolation one.
All right. Maya.
Oh, I also just wanted to quickly throw out one of my favorite signs that I saw at the march this weekend, which was that mental illnesses are global, but gun violence is unique to America, which I think is definitely something that, you know, we should really, really keep in mind while we're discussing this. And I agree with what everyone else has said about mental illnesses, but, you know, ultimately guns are the weapons that are, you know, causing these problems. And it's so unique to America. This doesn't happen in other countries.
So don't distract from the real cause of the problem here. Yes, Ali.
I just wanted to back up what Lola was talking about in terms of this issue with white supremacy and that seeing them and seeing white supremacists as shooters. You know, obviously we saw this with Dylann Roof and that whole incident. And this is something that, you know, the media is portraying these as, you know, these outcasts and, oh, they were putting a very sympathetic view on it. But the minute that we have something with police brutality, oh, he was a grown man at 13, right? And he was wielding a gun and things like that. And we need to shift that conversation.
You mean victims of police brutality?
Right, yeah, sorry, victims. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Victims of police brutality. And we need to shift that conversation. And as Lola said, we need to talk about discrimination and issues of racism. These are empowered white men who are feeling okay with doing this, and I think that is incredibly important to include in the conversation.
And I'm going to try to get one more caller in here. We have Keith. Keith, where are you calling from?
I am calling from Pioneer, California.
Welcome, Keith.
Hello. I just want to encourage all of you. You are really on message, and it's really exciting to hear the voices that you have. You are just nailing this. And please include people of color, because they're really part of the whole issue. And, oh, God. gosh, I'm really excited about the outcome of having you folks being leaders in this change that's coming along around the gun control issue. And it's straight out, if any of you want to run for election, you have my vote.
Oh boy, they're doubling over here. Thank you so much, Keith, for your call. So we have about 3 minutes left, and so I want to focus on this question: what does success look like for you in the short term, medium term, and you know, you got to throw in something here about scaling up and sustainability because we really can get there. Who wants to start with that? Okay, go ahead, Lola.
I think in the short term, you know, we've talked about it before. A lot of these things are, it looks like an uphill battle with the current Congress. So I think in the short term, it's electing a Democratic Congress that's going to get this done. And then I think also there's a lot of things we can do at the local level. You know, I'm the co-chair of the Marin County Youth Commission. And so there are some issues that I've seen the Marin County Board of Supervisors take action on that you wouldn't think they'd be able to. Marin County has a local ordinance that precludes Marin County from investing in, purchasing from, or otherwise doing business with any nuclear power contractors or nuclear weapons contractors. And I'd like to see that expanded to cover gun manufacturers. So I think looking into what you can do at the local level, what your local, you know, city council can do is a great first step.
Maya.
Yeah, definitely know who, what reps that represent you are taking money from the NRA. I know in California there are 16 current representatives out of our 53 that have taken money from the NRA. So Lola was saying, definitely voting them out, voting in the first place, vote in the midterms, and electing a Democratic Congress so we can see change.
Lily?
I would agree that everything that's been said so far, and one thing that I think we've talked about a lot in this conversation and that I want to make paramount is that we have to diversify this conversation mm-hmm. as we continue mm-hmm. to move. We cannot have it be something that is simply white kids talking on this issue. We have to include our black and brown peers at the very forefront of this movement. They've been marching about this for years and years now, and we have to recognize and respect that.
And Celi.
Obviously, with the midterms coming up, that's a very important first step, flipping the House. And also, just...
Go ahead.
Sort of making this an issue at every single election going forward. In 2018, it's going to be an issue. In 2020, it's going to be an issue. And we need to make it an issue until we're not seeing active shooter drills in school, until we're not seeing we're not seeing politicians take money from the NRA. It's going to be a long route, but it's one that we have to keep on.
And Brian DeLay, you get the last word.
Well, I think I'll just end by saying that, you know, I said at the outset that I was optimistic and I had a sense that things were changing. And having listened to this conversation with these wonderful young people, I feel even more optimistic. And I agree with everything they said. I think that, you know, we have to think about short-term, medium-term, long-term. Right now, it's all about the election. And, you know, there's power in example. There's power in the conversations you have with relatives and your neighbors and your parents. And there's power in being informed, as your wonderful guests are. So I'm inspired and optimistic.
Thank you. I just want to throw in a final email that just came in from Janelle saying, yes, I tear up with the wonderful passion of these young people. And as an 80-year-old, I see perhaps a broader view. I want to thank our guests tonight who joined us in this wonderful conversation, Celi Fong, Lily Connable, Maya Siegel, Lola Amador, and on the phone, UC Berkeley Professor Brian DeLay. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was co-produced by Ann Harper and Jennifer Ruick. Join me next Monday when I'll be talking to insiders at the upcoming San Francisco International Film Festival. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.